Support for Here and Now comes from BetterHelp, committed to supporting mental health through therapy. Clients are matched with one of 25,000 therapists and can communicate via video, chat, or phone at betterhelp.com/public.
I'm Robin Young. It's Here and Now. In Congress today, protesters disrupted hearings on the Bush administration's nominee for U.N. Ambassador, John Bolton, the conservative firebrand who once said it wouldn't matter if the top 10 floors of the United Nations building in New York were lost. Bolton, the president's current arms control chief, sought to allay critics' fears by pledging to work closely with the U.N., but he repeatedly came under intense scrutiny from Democrats today for allegedly intimidating analysts who disagreed with him on weapons intelligence. Joining us on the line from Washington is Daphna Linzer. She writes for the Washington Post. And Daphna, Foreign Relations Committee Chair Richard Lugar is a Republican, but his first question was also about John Bolton's alleged intimidation of analysts. So far, is Bolton's nomination in trouble?
That's a really good question. We're not exactly sure how everyone's going to vote. Lugar asked sort of the question of the day, which is whether or not Bolton did pressure or threaten analysts who disagreed with him on weapons of mass destruction. Allegations against him are the only public ones we know of a member of Bush administration who was accused of threatening an analyst. So that's the key question. Where the Republicans will fall is not totally clear. There's hope that Lincoln Chafee from Rhode Island, Republican senator, will vote against Bolton, but that's not clear that he will do that.
Well, in fact, you mentioned Senator Chafee, and we're going to have more later in the program on his interesting position in the Senate. But he did raise concerns that Bolton might go beyond current U.S. foreign policy on Taiwan or North Korea. How did Bolton address each of these concerns, that he allegedly intimidated analysts and that he's going to go outside U.S. foreign policy on Taiwan or North Korea?
On the analyst, he denied that he tried to get the at least one analyst from the State Department fired, but he did acknowledge that he wanted those analysts either removed from the portfolios they were working on or moved somewhere else within the State Department. It made it clear to him that he didn't really care where they were going to go. He just wanted them off the assignments they were on. One analyst in particular is an expert at the State Department on biological and chemical weapons, so it's not clear what other portfolio he could have had, but that's what Bolton said he wanted. On the issue of Taiwan, also very important, Bolton is a former paid advisor to Taiwan. He worked for Taiwan in the 1990s, writing all kinds of papers for them on trying to get them membership into the United Nations and into UN organizations. That's the most sensitive subject there is for China, and it's also not in line with today's Bush administration policy. So he was asked repeatedly to explain his own views versus the administration's. He said that he accepts the president's position. He supports it as a member of his administration and left it at that.
And at one point in his career, he was said to be talking of overthrowing the leader of North Korea when he was told reportedly by someone in the State Department, that's not our policy. He responded, regime change is exactly what we're all about. Was that raised today?
That's right. You know, that was alluded to, and he, you know, the State Department the State Department official who challenged Bolton on that point was the official responsible for talks with North Korea, a very respected former official named Charles Pritchard. He didn't deny dust up with Pritchard. He said that he respected Pritchard, but that Pritchard resigned because he was the one who was not in line with the president's policies. And Pritchard did indeed resign in August 2003, frustrated over how the administration was handling North Korea.
Well, Daphne, I just have to ask you, in the minute we have, supporters of Bolton have said that he might be just the man needed to galvanize the UN into action on important issues. He would take a tough love approach, and then that's needed. Did his supporters speak for him today as well?
Yes, he did have supporters speaking for him. He did have support from some Republicans who are on the Senate Foreign Relations Committee who feel, as you said, that Bolton is exactly the right person, that you need somebody who is tough-minded, who will say very clearly what the problems are within the United Nations and how they should be fixed. That is something that Bolton has tried to emphasize, that he knows the UN system quite well and knows exactly what's wrong with it, and that's what's most important.
Daphna Linzer, staff staff writer for The Washington Post, on today's hearings on John Bolton, the White House's nominee for UN ambassador. Daphna, thank you.
Thank you.
And now we want to spend some time with novelist Jonathan Safran Foer, whose much-anticipated second novel, Extremely Loud and Incredibly Close, is making its way up bestseller lists. It's hard enough to follow up a blockbuster like Foer's first book, Everything is Illuminated, written 3 years ago when he was just 25. But to add to the challenge, Jonathan's new book takes on 9/11. In the book, Oscar Schell is a precocious 9-year-old boy whose father was killed in the World Trade Towers. Oscar finds a key in his father's closet labeled black, so he thinks if he finds the lock that fits the key, he'll find out what really happened to his dad. So Oscar sets off to meet every person named Black listed in the greater New York area, at one point traveling to the Bronx to find Agnes Black, only to be told she was a waitress in the towers. She died that day as well.
"That's so weird to think about," I said. "What is?" "Well, that she worked there. Maybe she knew my dad, or not knew him, but maybe she served him that morning. He was there in the restaurant. He had a meeting. Maybe she refilled his coffee or something. It's possible. Maybe they died together. Maybe they'd gone up to the roof together. You saw in some of the pictures that people jumped together and held hands. So maybe they did that. Or maybe they just talked to each other until the building fell. What would they have talked about? They were obviously so different. Maybe he told her about me. I wonder what he told her. I couldn't tell how it made me feel to think about him holding somebody's hand."
Jonathan Safran Foer, reading from his new book, Extremely Loud and Incredibly Close, and he joins us in the studio to tell us more about the book. Welcome back.
Thank you. Nice to be back.
What a read. And we don't want to give away too much because there are plot twists and turns, but there are two storylines, the story of 9-year-old Oscar, whose father died on 9/11, and the story of what turns out to be Oscar's grandfather, who barely survives the Dresden firebombings. Now, in your first book, Everything is Illuminated, you tell the story of your own Polish-Jewish grandfather, who barely survived the Holocaust. His wife and child died. And we wondered, does Oscar's grandfather in the new book serve as a substitute for yours?
There's a great saying that I love. The poet W.H. Auden said, "I look at what I write so that I can see what I think." And that's how I feel. It's not the case that I start a book with a set of arguments I want to make, or points, or themes, or symbols. It's like walking down a dark hallway, and at the end you get to the light switch, and you turn around, and you see what the hallway really looked like. Mm-hmm. So, having finished this book, this grandfather really does resonate with my grandfather, and it was somebody I never met. He died long before I was born, but when I look at my book, I say, obviously, I've been thinking about him.
Yeah, there is a portion of the book that describes the firebombing at Dresden. It's pretty brutal, and it goes on for a couple of pages. And can you describe for us what is this writing from in the book? And then let's hear some of it.
So this is a letter that the grandfather wrote to his son. He sends a letter every day, or he writes a letter, rather, every day, and in fact, he doesn't send them. He just sends an empty envelope. This is one letter that it seems went through, and it's a description of what happened to him in the firebombing of Dresden, him moving from basically bomb shelter to bomb shelter as each is destroyed. In this specific scene, he passes a zoo. And this is something I read about in many, many different accounts, actually, of the firebombing of Dresden, people describing this ripped-open zoo and animals that were walking through the city. And in this scene, he's passing this zoo, and the zookeeper, whose eyes have been destroyed by the bombing, hands him a gun and says, "Could you please shoot all the carnivores so that we can spare the humans?" "I killed a camel with 12 bullets. I suspected it wasn't a carnivore, but I was killing everything. Everything had to be killed. A rhinoceros was banging its head against a rock again and again, as if to put itself out of its suffering or to make itself suffer. I fired at it. It kept banging its head. I fired again. It banged harder. I walked up to it and pressed the gun between its eyes. I killed it. I killed a zebra. I killed a giraffe. I turned the water of the sea lion's tank red. I tried to shoot the vultures, but I wasn't a good enough shot. Later, I saw vultures fattening themselves in the human carnage, and I blamed myself for everything."
A horrific scene from the Dresden firebombings. In the same book, a 9-year-old in Manhattan listening to phone messages of his father's last minutes before he dies in the World Trade Center. Jonathan Safran Foer, you've written, "As a writer, I'm trying to express those things that are scary to me because I'm alone with them." Was your head filled with the same thoughts as Oscar?
It was, but it was also filled with their opposites. You know, I don't think of the book as being a tragic book. It's a book that takes on a tragedy, but I think of it as being actually a very joyous book in many ways.
And hilariously funny at times.
I hope so. I hope so. And I hope it ends on a note that isn't depressive at all. It's not false. you know, it's not falsely optimistic. It's probably ambiguous, might be the best way to describe it. But the book is about characters who want to move forward and who do, in their own ways, move forward. So, you know, I was writing about something that was really horrible that happened, and it was something that, at the very least, everyone in New York and everyone in America, you know, was thinking about a lot and feeling very deeply. And it felt personal to everybody, regardless of whether or not you knew anyone who passed away, regardless of whether or not you lived in New York. It was one of these universally personal events. And I think those are exactly the kind of things that one should try to write about.
Well, you know, it's funny. A lot of people have asked you, why would you put these thoughts into the head of a 9-year-old? But as I was reading, I thought it's just perfect, because when you have Oscar trying to figure things out, well, we were all reduced to 9 years old when
right.
we were trying to figure things out.
Yeah, it's an ability to, you know, with a 9-year-old, you can strip away so much of what has happened to us since the event. We are not shocked by it really anymore. We're not so fearful as we were in those first days, and we're not even as sad, or the sadness has changed. But when we kind of strip all of that away, strip away all of our self-consciousness, all of these layers of protection that we've built around ourselves, it becomes very, very painful again. And I think it's maybe you can get closer to the actual experience of the event by seeing it through the eyes of somebody who's not as good at protecting himself.
Mm. He tries to protect himself, though. I'm just thinking of the ways that he tries to invent things. It's how he keeps his mind from his pain. And could you just tick off some of the things? I mean, it was such a marvelous visit inside a 9-year-old boy's head. Some of the things he wishes he could invent to change life or make it better.
Yeah. I mean, there are thousands in the book. He invents, what if there were a drain under everybody's pillows so that if they cried themselves to sleep at night, all of those tears could go to the reservoir in Central Park. And in the morning, the weatherman could say, well, the reservoir of tears has risen half an inch since yesterday. And then you could go outside knowing the general like climate, emotional climate of the city. He invents this idea that everyone should swallow microphones. And we could have little speakers in the pouches of our overalls that played the sounds of our heartbeats. So you could walk around sort of remembering that person you just called a jerk because he bumped into you actually has a heartbeat just like you do. It's things like that.
Or airplanes. So what were some of the airplanes?
Frozen airplanes that would be safe from heat-seeking missiles.
And still, all of this this inventing that he does doesn't keep him from also then going back to, if I were in the towers, would I have jumped or would I have stayed and burned? If I had my cell phone, what would I have said? You know, like many of us, he couldn't keep his head from that.
Yeah. In a way, it's the question of the book, whether all of his inventing, all of his imagination is helping him move away from something or if it's forcing him to move toward it, if it's a kind of heroic way of overcoming the tragedy or whether it's his way of succumbing to the tragedy. And in that very last moment in the book, when he imagines the whole day of September 11th moving in reverse and everyone in the end being safe, Is that something we should feel good about or bad about? You know, is that a kind of triumph for Oscar, or is it like the ultimate failure?
Jonathan Safran Foer, his new book is Extremely Loud and Incredibly Close. When we come back, how an experience that Jonathan had when he was also 9 might have figured into the new book, we'll find out. Stay with us. There's more ahead here and now. I'm Robin Young. It's Here and Now. We're talking with Jonathan Safran Foer. His new book, Extremely Loud and Incredibly Close, is the story of 9-year-old Oscar Schell trying to come to grips with his father's death in the Twin Towers on 9/11. It's also the story told in flashback through letters of Oscar's grandfather, who lives through the Dresden firebombing. The book is, oddly, often very funny at its core, but it is about, as characters often say, people bursting into flames as well. And I was wondering, Jonathan, where that came from. And then I saw buried in a New York Times profile on you before the book came out, something that happened to you when you were 9, an accident?
When I was 9 years old, I was in a summer class, and we were making sparklers. And there was an accident. There was an explosion. Several kids were very severely disfigured, almost died. And for absolutely no good reason, I was okay. I just happened to have left the room and come back right when it happened. So I was standing at the door. I was burned slightly. I mean, I had to spend a couple nights in a hospital.
But your friend had skin hanging off.
Yeah, awful things. It's actually funny. I was at I did a reading last night. A girl who was in that classroom was there and said hello. I hadn't seen her since then. In any case, I wasn't thinking about that when I wrote. I really wasn't. No part of me was.
You're kidding.
No. Nevertheless, the book is called Extremely Loud and Incredibly Close, which is a perfect description of my relationship to this explosion. It's about a 9-year-old who suffers this trauma and who, as a result, he finds refuge in his imagination. And that's probably what I did.
Mm.
It's, again, like I look at what I write so that I can see what I think. That's what I find so exciting about writing. There's nothing particularly interesting to me, actually, about the idea of taking all of my, all the thoughts I presently have and expressing them on paper. What's really exciting to me is, through the process of writing, figuring out who I am. And at the end of this book, just like at the end of my last book, I was very, very surprised with what I had come up with. I think people are all of the time wrong about who they think they are. You know, you think certain things are important to you, but until there's evidence in front of you, you can't really know for sure if that's right. There are all sorts of reasons you want to be thinking about certain things or you want to care about certain things. And when I finished this book, I could only look back and say, I've been thinking about that, when I was 9.
Yeah. What do we make of the fact that you can burst into flame in a second, third grade class because of an accident, because a teacher put out the wrong bowls of stuff, or because a terrorist wants to kill you, or because in Dresden the Allies say they want to save lives. Completely different ways of, horrible bursting into flame.
Yeah. There's another great line I love is the poet, a Polish poet, Zbigniew Herbert, said, the imagination is the instrument of compassion. And I really believe that, you can't prevent bad things from happening. We are not going to end terrorism by killing all of the terrorists. I wish, instead of sending soldiers, instead of even sending diplomats, we would send translators and get books, translated from Arabic. I wish that we would have paintings produced in the Middle East brought over here. I wish we could see the films that are being made there. There's plenty of art being made there, and it's just not coming here. Not only is it not, are we not encouraging it, we're really strongly discouraging it. I think that's how, again, imagination is the instrument of compassion. That's how we can get a sense of another culture's humanity, and that's how we can express our humanity. And given that we're not going to be able to prevent bad things from happening, whether it's in a science classroom or in a major American city, in the aftermath, we can only say, how can we become better people? How can we work to avoid this in the future?
You sound like Oscar Schell again, thinking of a way to invent to end the war. Maybe if we just send all translators over there.
Right.
You sound like Oscar, or Oscar sounds like you.
Yeah,
in that
well.
Way. Speaking of sounding like Oscar and speaking, like a precocious 9-year-old, can we just, lightning round, go through some of the things that he says?
And sure.
He constantly says things like birdseed shirt.
Right.
What's a birdseed shirt?
Birdseed shirt is one of his inventions for ways to make a quick escape. You can't fly. Humans don't have their own wings, so we need to borrow someone else's wings. Oscar's not the kind of kid who's going to take wings off a living animal, so he encourages the birds to come to him and carry him away.
Yeah. Heavy boots. I love that. People are going to start using that now, He has heavy boots.
To me, it's like it's a description of a mood that I have had many, many times in my life and hadn't been able to describe before. But heavy boots, for whatever reason, fits it for me.
Yeah, it's the weight of the world in your feet. It's just pulling you down.
Yeah.
A lot of the reviews have compared Oscar to Salinger's Alden Caulfield, to Macaulay Culkin in Home Alone, to Madeline, who lived in the plaza, to that kid from 1,000 Clowns. We saw comparisons with Oscar in The Tin Drum, German author Günther Grass's book. This is a 3-year-old who beats on a drum. Apparently you had him in mind as well.
I did. To be honest, that's the only comparison that makes any sense to me. I haven't read most of those books that you just mentioned. I obviously read Catcher in the Rye just because I'm a living, breathing American, and I think every other one has.
But tell us about Little Oscar in Tin Drum. And why.
Oh, well, The Tin Drum is just such a wonderful book. It really changed my life. I'm sure I wouldn't be a writer if I hadn't read that book, because it confronts awful tragedies in an incredibly interesting new way. It's, with a little bit of surrealism, a little bit of humor, and a whole lot of emotion. And Oscar, in that book, is a character who willfully chooses not to grow up, because all of the models of adulthood around him are so horrible.
This is during the Nazi
regime. Yeah, he's a German. Sorry, mm-hmm. I didn't mm-hmm. mention that.
Mm-hmm.
So it was something that was on my mind very much.
And by the way, Little Oscar in The Tin Drum, as I said, he beats on a drum to sort of keep at bay his fears in the world. And your Oscar beats a tambourine as he walks around. What an image.
Well, they're also kind of miniature soldiers in a way, you know, soldiers in a different kind of army. You know, in the tin drum, we think of a drum as being like a an instrument in a marching band, something that the soldier at the head of the line is beating, and that's not who Oscar in that book is, and it's not who Oscar in my book is. Oscar says, I think somewhere in the first four pages, that he's a pacifist. He's a different model of person.
Yeah, he certainly is. By the way, what does Jonathan do? I mean, obviously a drum and a tambourine wouldn't go over that well, but to keep fears at bay, I mean, is there something?
Yeah, I write. Yeah. That's what I do. That's my drum.
Jonathan Safran Foer, his new book is Extremely Loud and Incredibly Close. Thanks for talking to us about it.
Thank you.
Here and Now, the documentary film American Jobs, getting to the pulse of blue-collar and white-collar workers whose jobs were lost to the global economy. That's tomorrow. Stay with us. There's more ahead, Here and Now. I'm Robin Young. It's Here and Now. And as we heard earlier, confirmation hearings for President Bush's nominee for UN Ambassador, John Bolton, are underway today in the Senate Foreign Relations Committee. One member of that committee could hold the swing vote, Rhode Island Republican Lincoln Chafee. Senator Chafee has gone back and forth on whether he supports Bolton's nomination, despite general opposition from his constituents. Meanwhile, Chafee is facing a tough re-election battle down the road. For more, we turn to Charlie Baxt, a political columnist for the Providence Journal. He spoke with Here and Now's Bob Oakes.
Charlie, if you would, give us the quick take on this. Is Lincoln Chafee vulnerable?
Well, supposedly he's vulnerable. The Democrats consider him one of the top two targets in the whole country in 2006. It is a Democratic state. The Democrats have a top-heavy majority in both the House and Senate. They have the two House seats. They have the other Senate seat. On the other hand, the Republicans have the governorship, and the Chafees, that is Lincoln and his father, have held this Senate seat since 1976.
Which I think leads to this question. How popular is Lincoln Chafee with the voters, given the family's long hold on the seat?
Well, I think he's pretty popular, and I think he's going to be hard to beat, especially if the Democrats have a tough, bitter primary, which they show every signs of having.
Well, tell us a little bit about the two candidates on the Democratic side, the Secretary of State Matthew Brown and the former Attorney General and U.S. Attorney Sheldon Whitehouse.
Matt Brown is a relative newcomer to politics. He's always appeared to be very ambitious from the very first days in office. He's sought to expand the portfolio, you might say, of the Secretary of State, gotten involved in things the Secretary of State wouldn't normally get involved in, such as the price of drugs, organizing bus trips to Canada for people to buy drugs cheaper. He had a health task force. The former Attorney General, Sheldon Whitehouse, much more experienced in public office. He was the state business regulation director for a while. He was the U.S. attorney. He was the state attorney general, which is a very powerful position in Rhode Island and a very controversial position. Mr. Whitehouse has made no secret of his interest in returning to public office. He was looking at governor for the coming election. He was looking at lieutenant governor. And finally, things broke pretty well for him in the race for Senate, so he entered the Senate race.
Charlie, let's talk a little bit more about Senator Chafee. The senator has indicated that he might vote to confirm John Bolton, President Bush's controversial choice to be the next U.S. ambassador to the United Nations, but he also says that he's going to wait to see what happens during the confirmation hearings. Has he been under enormous pressure from the White House to vote the White House's way on this issue when he's known for not voting with the White House on many other important issues to the White House?
He has voted differently from the White House on a whole bunch of issues, most notably on the president's tax cuts. As a matter of fact, he didn't even vote for President Bush for president the second time around. He wrote in the name of President Bush's father. Senator Chafee also did not vote for the war in Iraq. He voted against that. And he differs with the White House on a whole bunch of issues, including drilling in Alaska and abortion. And, of course, the White House isn't crazy about it. On the other hand, they know that he's part of the Republican majority, and it helps, you know, make that majority. And so I'm not sure how they could pressure him exactly. They need him.
So, oddly enough, if in the coming election the Democrats should unseat Chafee, they unseat one of their best friends, so to speak.
Well, very often he's a friend of theirs. Now, one of the probably the main item of dialogue in the campaign is going to be, on the one hand, you have Chafee, who portrays himself as sort of an independent kind of voter, somebody who uses his judgment, votes his conscience, and so on. He's in the tank for nobody. That's his story, and people have always bought that story, whether it came from him or his father. Over the years, Democratic challengers have always said in one form or another, you know, look, we're crazy to send a Democrat and a Republican down there. We should have two Democrats. The other side of the coin, and you've been hearing this already from Sheldon Whitehouse, is we need a senator who will be voting what's right for Rhode Island all the time. Well, that's Sheldon Whitehouse's story. And then the other twist on this is Matt Brown, who portrays himself really as sort of outside politics and who says, you know, the politicians haven't come up with solutions. I spent 10 years working in the community with real people, working on real solutions. That's the line of chatter that we're hearing early in the campaign.
So, Charlie, it'll be a long campaign. We'll have to see how it goes or where it goes.
Well, I was thinking the other day it's going to be so long that candidates will be going to the annual events twice, you know, in Bristol, Rhode Island, for instance. This is a huge 4th of July parade.
The oldest in the nation.
Yes, it's a big, big thing. And there are a lot of annual events that politicians show up at. And these guys are headed for two appearances.
Charlie Baxt, thanks a lot.
My pleasure.
Charlie Baxt is a political columnist for the Providence Journal. He spoke with Here Now's Bob Oakes.
This is a lovely day. I think they deserve every happiness and support from other people as well, which I do believe they have.
If they come by and I could shake her hand or his hand, I would be in heaven. I really wouldn't care.
It's absolutely wonderful. I can't tell you how ecstatic I am because I can't wait for this wedding. I'm so thrilled.
They both need to settle the situation, to be married, to live a normal life, irrespective of what happened before. They deserve a really good chance.
Sounds of spectators at the wedding of Prince Charles to Camilla, the Duchess of Cornwall, this past Saturday. Coming up, a look at the state of the British monarchy. You might be surprised at today's polling results. And as always, we welcome your thoughts on anything on the program. Send us an email at letters@here-now.org. That's letters@here-now.org. Or you can call our listener line and leave us a message at 617-358-0397. That's 617-358-0397. Please remember to tell us how to pronounce your full name and the town you're from. There's more ahead here and now. Congress is considering a plan to keep a closer eye on mortgage loan giants Fannie Mae and Freddie Mac. Treasury Secretary John Snow will testify on the issue Wednesday before the House Financial Services Committee. Fannie and Freddie, which hold or guarantee more than 45% of all home loans in the country, have both been racked by accounting scandals, and critics worry that if the companies falter, financial markets could go into a tailspin. Well, here now, business reporter Mark Mills joins us to talk about why Fannie and Freddie are under such close scrutiny, and for some of us, what the heck they do. Mark, welcome.
Thanks, Robin.
What do these companies do? Explain it.
Well, it's a good place to start on this. They were created by the federal government, but they are private companies with stock traded on the New York Stock Exchange. And their main function is to buy up mortgages from lenders, bundle those mortgages together, and then issue bonds to investors. So let's take an example here. Say a homeowner takes out a $250,000 mortgage at a bank. Fannie or Freddie might buy that loan back from the bank. So the bank gets its money back plus some profit for originating the loan. Mm-hmm. And then Fannie and Freddie would bundle loans together. They might take 40 quarter-million-dollar loans and create a package worth $10 million. Then they would sell slices of that loan package to investors who then receive a share of the principal and interest paid off each month by homeowners. Fannie and Freddie then recycle the money back into new mortgages. The system has provided a huge amount of capital for the housing market, and that's helped to keep interest rates lower and made homes more affordable to millions of people.
So it does make sense. So why is Congress getting ready to tighten regulation of Fannie Mae and Freddie Mac?
Critics like Alan Greenspan, the Federal Reserve Chairman, say their loan portfolios have gotten too big. A total of $1.8 trillion in debt has been issued by Fannie and Freddie. And if we had a big jump in interest rates and one or both of these companies faltered and defaulted on their debts, it could wreak havoc on the financial markets. Fannie and Freddie bonds are held by many financial institutions, and if a number of those institutions suffered multi-billion-dollar losses all at the same time, it could cause financial markets to tank, the dollar could drop, interest rates would spike. I mean, this would be a very serious financial crisis. Mm. On top of that, both companies have had accounting scandals in the last couple of years, and the CEOs of both Fannie and Freddie have been forced to resign. So that has kind of weakened them politically and given their critics leverage to get Congress to tighten regulation.
And what is Congress considering?
Well, Republicans are proposing the creation of a new body, regulatory body, with expanded powers to oversee these companies. Currently, Fannie and Freddie are regulated by, this is a great name, the Office of Federal Housing Enterprise Oversight, or OFEO, one of the worst acronyms in Washington, which is saying something. OFEO has been cracking down in the past year, but has been seen by many as ineffective in regulating and unable to really handle the complex task of reining in these companies. So the debate is over what powers to give the new regulating body. Some of the things they're talking about would be limiting the size of their loan portfolios, as Greenspan wants, the power to approve or disapprove of new mortgage products, and the power to limit the types of investments that the companies can make. It's not clear yet what will be included in the final bill.
Well, in addition, you mentioned Republicans. What are the Democrats saying?
Well, Senator Charles Schumer has been the most outspoken about this, the New York senator. He has said too much regulation of Fannie and Freddie could hurt here. He feels the companies have opened up home ownership to millions of people, and he fears that too much regulation will lead to higher mortgage rates, which could hurt lower income and middle class families who are striving for home ownership. Fed Chairman Greenspan says the reforms could be phased in such a way to avoid a jump in mortgage rates, but Schumer, actually, in testimony this past week with Greenspan there, Schumer told Greenspan it almost defies belief that mortgage rates won't go up if we do this.
And what happens if that catastrophe that you outlined, is the federal government responsible for stepping in to pay the debts of Fannie and Freddie if they go under? Could this be another savings and loan bailout situation?
People do worry about that, Robin. The government is not legally obligated to pay off Fannie and Freddie debt. There is widespread belief, however, that the feds would not allow these companies to go under, that they're too big to fail. Fannie and Freddie have been able to use that to help actually issue debt at favorable rates. So there is a risk to the federal government that if they fail, there could be big bills due by the taxpayers, and that's why Congress is stepping in.
And as you said, taking it up in legislation on a Wednesday. Well, thank you, Mark Mills. Explaining once again the incomprehensible.
You're welcome, Robin.
Here and Now's business reporter Mark Mills. More ahead here and now. I'm Robin Young. It's Here and Now. So happy, read the Sunday Express newspaper in London. The Independent took another tack. The End of the Affair, read its headline. Its coverage of the royal wedding relegated to page 4. Prince Charles and his bride Camilla are honeymooning in Scotland after Saturday's much-anticipated wedding. Question now is, what's the future of the British throne? Judy Wade covers royalty for Hello Magazine. Hello, Judy.
Hi, Robin.
So what is the verdict on the day after? We know some polls have been taken.
Although there's a poll out today saying that people are still sort of rather not very keen on having Camilla as queen, and they'd rather have William succeed the present queen, and that leaves Charles out in the cold, there has been a surprising response to Camilla herself. I think, you know, the second outfit she wore, that very sort of medieval floor-sweeping gown that she wore to St. George's Chapel, that really clinched it for her. People thought she looked lovely, and people are now sort of saying, well, just leave them in peace, let them be happy.
So from this side of the pond, it doesn't seem as if the hat with the feathers was too much of a negative. I don't mean to be... Did the hat go over well? We should say there was a hat with big feathers coming out of it.
Well, the photographers hated it because they couldn't see her face, and a lot of people commented that she looked like the mother of the bride, not the bride.
Oh, dear.
It's the sort of outfit you wear to Ascot, not to a wedding, really, especially right. A wedding of this sort of significance.
You mentioned something else we want to touch on. It must have been sobering for Prince Charles to see that 42% said, as you said, that he should step aside and let his son, Prince William, be king when the current Queen Elizabeth dies. That's up from 34% who said the same in a poll 4 years ago. So they've said this in the past, but 42%.
Well, it's true, but Prince Charles and William don't want that to happen, especially not immediately, because they feel that William deserves to have a bit of normal life before he takes on the burden of the monarchy. You know, I mean, even if Prince Charles does become king, it'll be a very short reign, because now he's approaching 60, whereas William's only 22. So they would like him to have a bit more training time, I imagine. So no matter what the public thinks, the royal family will do what they like, unless they're pushed into it by the government and the public.
But, well, we were going to ask you about that. I mean, polls really don't mean anything when it comes right down to it, do they?
Well, not really. I mean, I've always found that the Queen and the rest of the royal family, the only poll they take notice of is the mailbag they get from the public. Each morning, the Queen dips into the mailbag and pulls out about 8 or 10 letters, and she opens those and reads them. And they're sort of selected at random. She does read some letters from the public. And, I mean, I think, you know, they especially don't take any notice of the press because they think we've all got our own agenda. So they really notice what people say to them. The people who take the trouble to write to them, they believe that's a much truer reflection of what people are thinking.
Well, for instance, the polls also showed that 63% of the respondents said Camilla should not become queen if Charles takes the throne. First of all, explain to us, I mean, is there a possibility that he could become king and her not queen?
I can't see it. I mean, I've said all along, long before this marriage was even a sort of glimmer on the horizon, I've said that, you know, if he marries her, she automatically becomes queen. That's the British law. A wife takes on the same rights and titles as her husband. So there's no two ways about it. And there has been a lot of fudging from Clarence House saying that, oh, she's only going to be called Duchess of Cornwall and, oh, you know, she'll never be called queen. But it isn't true. I mean, I'm sure that Prince Charles is secretly hoping that we'll come to like Camilla and we won't mind if she's called queen. I mean, there was a clue to this on Saturday when she wore that Prince of Wales feathered brooch on her lapel on the white outfit. It was a very significant brooch because it's a black pearl set with diamonds around it, and on the top of it there's a sort of a fleur-de-lis sort of shape, the Prince of Wales three feathers, and it was originally given, or it originally belonged to Camilla's great-grandmother, Alice Keppel, the one who was the mistress of Edward VII. Mm-hmm. And at one stage, a couple of years ago, Prince Charles bought it at auction and gave it to Camilla. Now, it seems to me the fact that she flaunted that on Saturday suggests to me that she does consider herself Princess of Wales. I mean, he's Prince of Wales, therefore she's Princess of Wales.
Well, what overall do you think is the future of the monarchy? I mean, is this a moment where the monarchy we're watching the monarchy die? Or, you know, as we see people in polls respond more favorably to Camilla, is this in fact maybe a turning point for the better for the future of the monarchy?
Well, it could be a turning point for Camilla. I think about for the monarchy, because 67% of people in a recent poll said that they thought that Camilla had done an enormous amount of damage to the monarchy and that she could do even more. I mean, even one of the men who knows her best, Mark Boland, who used to be Prince Charles's deputy private secretary, he wrote an article at the weekend saying that Camilla is monumentally lazy. He said one of her family said that she is the laziest woman of the 20th century. Nobody has ever been lazier than Camilla. So I can't envisage how Camilla is going to get on planes and start going around the world shaking hands with millions of people, especially if she hates flying. So, you know, she's not just taken on a man, she's taken on a job. And Camilla's never really worked in her entire life. So I think it's going to be very hard for her to adapt. And she was terribly, terribly nervous on Saturday. I mean, you know, her hands were shaking. And apparently she didn't eat all day and she was nearly fainting by the end of the ceremony in St. George's Chapel. Now, that seems to me really silly to behave like that, but she was obviously overcome with nerves.
Well,
and when she got to the reception, they had to rush and get her a sandwich quickly because she was just absolutely, you know, on the point of collapsing.
One last question for you, Judy. We were struck here by how the poet laureate of Britain was, at least by press accounts, struggling to write an appropriate poem for the day.
That's because this is unprecedented. We've never had a future king get married for the second time. And, you know, as the nation's quite divided about whether this marriage should have happened, I'm sure he found it difficult to write a sort of celebratory poem.
Well, and in fact, it has to be the first celebratory poem that included the word scandal.
Yes.
But it had sort of a beautiful take on the marriage that it was nature taking its course. How did people respond to it?
Well, people have mostly ignored it. It hasn't received much publicity at all here. People have now moved on. We've got an election coming in about 4 weeks, and so, you know, everybody's turning their attention to that.
Judy Wade covers royalty for Hello magazine. Judy, thanks so much.
My pleasure. Thanks, Robin.
And I have to say, we really loved that poem by Andrew Motion with its, you know, its sort of goodbye to scandal.
I don't think they're getting away from scandal. Prince Charles has never been faithful to one woman, and I don't think he's going to be faithful to Camilla.
And if he is, you're out of a job.
Well, I suppose you're right there, yes.
Judy, thank you.
Okay.
And here's a reading of the poem written for the wedding of Charles and Camilla.
I took your news outdoors and strolled a while in silence on my square of garden ground, where I could dim the roar of arguments, ignore the scandal flywheel whirring round. And here instead the green fuse in the flower ignite, the breeze stretch out a shadow hand to ruffle blossom on its sticking points, the blackbirds sing and, singing, take their stand. I took your news outdoors and found the spring had honored all its promises to start disclosing how the principles of earth can make a common purpose with the heart. The heart which slips and sidles like a stream weighed down by winter wreckage near its source, but given time and come the clearing rain, breaks loose to revel in its proper course.
Here and Now is a production of WBUR Boston. I'm Robin Young. Please join us again, Here and Now.
For a cassette or CD of Here and Now, go to our website, here-now.org, or call 1-800-909-9287. Cassettes or CDs are $15 each, which includes shipping and handling.
Funding for Here and Now comes from the MathWorks, creators of MATLAB and Simulink technical computing software, on the web at mathworks.com.